court is now ready to hear arguments in the final calls for the morning. Remington Arms Sports Company versus Caldwell. The court is ready to hear the arguments.
May it please the court, Mr. Lee Ware and Mr. Don Jackson will present argument for rebuttal. They have reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal. Mr. Ware will take the first 10 minutes and will also present the rebuttal.
May it please the court, I'm Lee Ware, counsel for the relator of the Remington Arms Company. My co-counsel are Bill Kilgarland, Rusty Manings, Don Jackson. Mr. Bill Gordon, acting as personal counsel for the president of Remington, is also present in court today. I will present the argument on the point that the trial court violated Remington's due process rights and that it abused its discretion in imposing post-trial death penalty sanctions. Being assured and assuming that the court has read the briefing and is familiar somewhat with the facts, I will not discuss them in great detail. If a judge or a briefing attorney, for that matter, has a question concerning the facts, then I recommend the court to three documents that are contained in the record. The first is a transcript, cite to page 1400 of the transcript. That is good for reference to facts occurring prior to May of 1988. The second is tab 22 in Remington's mandamus exhibits. That's good for facts occurring after May of 1989. And finally, the transcript page 1649, also good for facts of what occurred after May of 1989. Turning now to the argument. The violation of due process rights is an argument that follows from this court's opinion in Transamerican Natural Gas. There has been no failure on the part of Remington Arms Company to comply with a lesser sanction order in the conduct of discovery in this case.
There was a lesser sanction.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
There was a lesser sanction order.
There was a lesser sanction. That was a $25,000 sanction. Subsequent to that time, there has been no failure by Remington to comply. If I may, I will discuss three areas pointing out the reason for that I make that conclusion. First, the team minutes. I want to tell the court that the team minutes are not the NBAR documents that have been up here on other matters. The team minutes consist of records of teams that are in the charge of conducting Remington's business. They were presented to the special master in the order in which they are kept at Remington, which is chronologically. Judge Martinez, at the time that he imposed sanctions, had no live discovery request for the team minutes. Mr. Craig withdrew his discovery request for the team minutes prior. His withdrawal of his request is in Exhibits A and B of our suggestion of authority that was filed about 2 weeks ago. On January the 17th, 1990, about a week prior to trial, Judge Martinez signed an order, which is at tab 22 in the, tab 16 in our documents, or in our exhibits to the mandamus, and that order denies any sanctions having to do with the team minutes. That's a week prior to trial. In the face of this, with no live discovery request for the team minutes, Judge Martinez simply did not have any basis for saying that we were not in compliance with any discovery request. If there is not a showing of failure to comply, then there is, in that instance, no basis for the presumption that Transamerica requires, and there's a violation of due process rights, and that is not a matter within the trial court's discretion under that opinion. The team minutes were produced in camera. They were produced on November the 28th, 1989, to the special master. That's compliance. That is not an act of noncompliance. The special master sustained our objections to 6,444 pages. He ruled that we had to disgorge 5 pages, and he denied them sanctions. We filed a mandamus. The special master, when he finally got around to signing the order on January the 17th, 1990, gave us 1 day of stay of execution, and that during that 1 day, we filed the mandamus timely. That is not a failure to comply with a discovery order imposing lesser sanctions. The 14th Court of Appeals granted us leave to file. This court refused to interfere with the stay of the 14th Court of Appeals. Mr. Longley, at that point in time, withdrew his request. We proceeded to trial, and there was no mention made of sanctions on the team minutes at any time during trial, and it next arose post-trial. At that point in time, 13 judges and one special master had sent me absolutely no signal that I'm not in compliance with some discovery order. second area of discussion has to do with the aerial photographs. First, there was never a request made on a request for document production for any and all of our photographs. There was a voluntary compliance by Remington in that photographs that were in the possession of Remington of the firearm and of the ranch and the vehicle that may have been involved in this particular accident were voluntarily produced as something that our expert witnesses might rely on at trial. The aerial photographs were not produced at that time because the aerial photographs were not taken until subsequently. At the time that they were taken, there was a lawyer representing the plaintiff present. Lloyd Koenig, a professional photographer out of Houston, took the photographs. And Mr. Jackson, my co-counsel, who was there, told the lawyer representing the plaintiff, you can get a copy of these from Mr. Koenig, and instructed Mr. Koenig to just give him a copy if he wanted a copy. That is, in my books, a compliance, and that is production. Voluntary production, because they were never requested. At trial, Mr. Craig objected to the introduction of the aerial photographs. They were never relied upon by any expert. His objection was overruled. At that point in time, he had an appellate point, and that's all that he is entitled to. Third area of discussion, Mr. Hutton's testimony. Mr. Jim Hutton, is an engineer at Remington, gun designer. If there's any sentiment for sanctioning my client because we made a bill of exceptions lasting 30 to 45 minutes in a four-week trial, I need to address that at this time. Mr. Hutton testified in deposition twice prior to trial. He was produced twice, I think voluntarily. That's compliance with discovery request. He testified at trial that one of the reasons that he did not think the accident happened as the plaintiff's witnesses said it happened was because of the path of the bullet. At trial, I asked him a question, and the question was to the effect of, is the path of the bullet important to you in your opinion as to how the accident happened? Objection was made. The objection was sustained. At a subsequent time, we went on with the testimony, and at a subsequent time, there was a bill of exceptions made. That is not a discovery abuse. The Alvarado opinion, which is discussed in the brief, says that not allowing the testimony is the appropriate sanction and the only sanction for a failure of a witness to disclose something on a deposition.
Mr. Ware, you're making a very fact-specific argument, which I think perhaps is necessary in this case, but let me stop and ask a global question. Can a trial judge ever grant mistrial and then go proceed only to damages as a sanction after a trial?
I do not think.
Would you say it's always a due process?
I would say that if a plaintiff gets to the point, or a defendant for that matter, gets to the point where the presumption that's required by Transamerica is raised, I would say that once you get after trial, you have got the volumes of the trial record to rebut whatever presumption there is that's made, and that it may never be done, Your Honor, absent some type of abuse occurring.
If the trial judge had granted a new trial, you would, of course, have no complaint, correct?
He granted a new trial, Your Honor.
I mean, if he granted a new trial into both liability and damages, that would be within a trial judge's discretion.
Certainly.
The trial judge could say you can lose this case, but you can't win it.
The place where we are at the present time in our procedure is that he may always grant the new trial.
Is it the granting of the new trial, the granting of the motion for a new trial, that voids everything that happened before then?
Does it void everything that happened before? It doesn't void everything that happened before, Your Honor. No.
As it relates to the topic we have up here today on conduct that could be sanctioned.
On the facts that you have before you today, my position is that it does. As to whether that is a global situation, you would have to give me a hypothetical and let me address it. I'm not prepared to tell you that it would void everything that occurred before. If you are in trial, for example, if I may supply Your Honor a hypothetical, if you are in trial and during the course of the trial, the judge becomes aware of the way that the reason why the trial is going the way it's going is because there has been a type of discovery abuse that is outcome determinative, the judge might at that point in time make a decision to mistry the case and go back and put the case back in the discovery posture. And I'm not prepared to say that that is not something that this court would deprive the trial court of the right to do necessarily.
Are you saying, since we'll be writing for more than this case, that the judge can...
Last time, Your Honor, you did a great job, and which I'm very appreciative.
Are you saying that the trial judge cannot do that on a motion for a new trial, granting a motion for a new trial, and then go back and do that?
I'm saying that a trial court cannot, on the facts that are here, when there's compliance with discovery and only compliance with discovery, grant a new trial and then sanction immediately after without something else occurring. That's what I'm saying, Your Honor. If the court is asking my advice on a global rule, my advice on a global rule would be that if you are into the trial and if there must be a rule that covers all cases, that it should not be permitted. The trial court should not be given that. Thank you, Your Honor.
Let me ask Mr. Ware before you step away. It just occurred to me, is there nothing the trial court can do if the trial court believes during the course of the trial that some discovery abuse that perhaps was not apparent earlier that's been revealed during trial, is there nothing the trial court can do short of granting a new trial?
Well, I think what the trial court should do at that point in time is to step back, consider Transamerica, and look at the lesser sanction and the suitability of the lesser sanction. If it's not already in place, it depends upon what has happened prior to trial. Certainly, I'm not going to take the unreasonable position. It may just take a second. I'm not going to take what I consider to be an unreasonable position that the trial court can discover something in trial, and just because the trial court is in trial is precluded from doing something about it. But I think that what needs to happen is the trial judge needs to look at where the case is and then follow the trial map that's been provided in Transamerica and Walker. In the Chrysler opinion the court handed down recently, to see what must be done.
So the court would have the authority to impose, say, a monetary sanction if discovery abuse that was revealed during trial, which the trial court determined should be addressed by a monetary sanction?
I believe so, Your Honor, or the other lesser sanctions that are authorized.
If that's true, why shouldn't, in an appropriate case, unless talked hypothetically, why couldn't the trial court do what it did here, not in this case, but let's say in an appropriate case?
In an appropriate case, if you're talking about a case where it would be appropriate for the court to mistry the case?
Where a case where it would be appropriate for a trial judge to render a death penalty sanction.
In an appropriate case, if the trial court gets to the point of the death penalty sanction, if the presumption is raised, the fact that you are in trial causes a problem only if you've announced ready for trial, and if you're there voluntarily. In that sense, it would seem to me that you don't get the death penalty sanction. But if there were appropriate orders in place, the abuse, the flagrant bad faith comes out at trial, then I think the trial court can act accordingly under Transamerica and Walker and under the Chrysler case.
So you would not propose that we write an opinion embracing a rule prohibiting the trial judge from rendering a death penalty sanction in an appropriate case if that is facts giving the trial judge's attention become apparent during trial?
I'm not urging that because I believe that you should, and I believe this court will, whenever possible, leave discretion with the trial judge. And when the trial judge, all of you being, as I am, mindful of the fact that the trial judge gets confronted with different situations every time one goes to trial, the discretion and what he is allowed to do, to the extent that it comports with due process, ought to be left with him. But if it's a due process concern and the due process presumption is not there, I do not think you should ever let him in this trial case just for the purpose of imposing death penalty sanctions.
May it please the court, I believe I have just a couple of minutes, and in that time I do want to hit one point, and it's related to the discussion that was that we were just having, but it's slightly different. And that is specific to this case. This case is a little bit different situation in terms of what the judge was authorized to do because Judge Martinez was a visiting judge sitting pursuant to a specific appointment of him as a visiting judge. Rule 300 of the Texas Rules of Civil Procedure requires the court to deal with, in some manner, a jury verdict. Here we have a jury verdict that exonerates Remington of any liability in the case. Rule 300 requires the court to do one of two or three things. That is that the court either renders a judgment on that verdict as a ministerial act, and this court is so held in the case of Trawick versus Goodrich which unfortunately is not in our briefing. It's 364 Southwest 2nd, 190, Texas 1963. That is a ministerial act with a verdict that is a good, complete verdict without conflict. His other options, of course, are if there is no evidence to support the jury's verdict or a particular finding in the jury's verdict, he may render either a J&OB or a judgment notwithstanding, setting aside a particular finding of the jury. What the court did, and I'll be very brief, in this case is...
What's he not allowed to do?
Beg your pardon, Your
Honor. How did he exceed his authority?
What the judge did in this case was he granted a new trial. We contend that the order headed mistrial cannot be anything but a new trial because that is what the court had before him as his options, either to render judgment on the verdict, J&OB, set aside a particular finding of the verdict of the jury for lack of evidence, or he had to render a new trial.
Judge, you could have rendered judgment on the verdict and then granted a mistrial.
Your Honor,
there would be no error in that.
Your Honor, I have not looked at that specifically. It would be my contention, at least in the situation he's in here, that the mistrial is not an option. And I'm not sure that I would agree that that would be an option had he rendered judgment on the verdict. Of course, here he didn't. And it's our position that under the appointment order, as soon as he granted a new trial, his appointment had ended, his authority had ended, and his later orders of default judgment and sanctions are void.
So during the court's plenary power, it couldn't have reinstated the entered judgment in your favor?
Your Honor, I believe what the order of appointment says is that he may rule through the point of new trial and matters growing out of the trial. I believe that under Roberts versus Ernst, he is limited to those rulings. Therefore, once he granted a new trial, the effect of that law is to put us back at the very start. In other words, we're back in February 22nd, whatever it was, of 1989, before trial started, January 22nd, 1990. Remington is in full compliance. Two motions for sanctions are overruled. Everybody, discovery is complete. Everybody's at the courthouse ready to go to trial. Craig has withdrawn his request for the 15 minutes. That's where we are. As soon as he granted that new trial, Your Honor, we contend that that's where we are, and therefore the master's report is now a nullity, and anything that occurred at trial is no longer before the court for consideration.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. Court is ready to hear argument from respondents.
We have been support Mr. David Clark and Mr. Joe Longley.
Please support, counsel. I'm David Clark, and I represent Debbie James, Remington's co-defendant in this case. I'd like to speak to one issue, and that is the portion of the court's sanction order that precludes Remington from seeking contribution or indemnity from Debbie James. Remington complains that that in itself is improper. The principal defense that Debbie James has in this case is that the Remington rifle was defective. And from that single perspective, in that single point, she is aligned with David Craig. Now, we know that a party is entitled to rely upon another party's discovery. And that's what Debbie James did in this case. Relied on David Craig's discovery as to the defectiveness of the product. And so, therefore, to the extent that a sanctions order against Remington is proper as to David Craig, it is equally proper as to Debbie James, since any discovery abuse that prejudiced David Craig would prejudice Debbie James equally. The trial court must have discretion to fashion discovery orders, including discovery sanctions, in order to do justice, to accomplish the purposes of Rule 250, and to meet the requirements of Transamerican. Transamerican required a sanction order to be fair, and in order to be fair, it had to visit sanctions upon the party, the offending party. Now, clearly, you cannot sanction an innocent third party for another party's discovery abuse. That's been clear, and Transamerican states that again. In this case, if Remington is allowed contribution and indemnity against Debbie James, what is happening is they are accomplishing that indirectly that they can't accomplish directly. They are asking for contribution and indemnity from Debbie James, an innocent third party, essentially for their own discovery abuse. And two of the purposes of sanctions are to deter and to punish. And clearly, if an offending party can seek contribution and indemnity from an innocent co-defendant, then those purposes cannot be accomplished under Rule 215.
Any questions?
Thank you.
Thank you, Captain.
May it please the Court. A couple of points on behalf of the respondents in response to the argument that has been made. First of all, there was a sanctions order that was entered by Judge Caldwell on January of, or actually it was February the 6th of 1989. That was where the $25,000 monetary sanction was imposed, and likewise there was an additional sanction imposed at that time of having Remington pay for the special master who had already been appointed by agreement of the parties. There was an additional sanction order, as the Court knows, on May the 21st, 1990, and in that sanction order, Judge Martinez, this was his order, ordered that there would be no further discovery in addition to the other sanctions on behalf of Remington. After this Court sent a mandamus back for review by Judge Martinez in consideration of the rules laid down in Transamerican, it came to the judge's attention, it's not disputed, that Remington was in violation of at least the May 21st and both, we say, the February 6th order as well. The special master's fees had not been paid by Remington as ordered by Judge Caldwell's first order, and Remington admitted that they had attempted to get out discovery after the prohibition of discovery in the May 21st, 1990 order. There was evidence put on of both of those violations of those orders at the reconsideration that this Court ordered back before Judge Martinez, and so the record is supported that they were in violation of both sanctions orders and both discovery orders that were contained in those sanctions orders at the time we went back on reconsideration after Transamerica. Wanted to make sure that that was clear in the record since it did not, it seemed to be obfuscated in the beginning argument. The special master made his finding, by the way. You look at tab 58 in respondents' exhibits. The report of the master made the finding that Remington intentionally and their attorneys intentionally engaged in delay with regard to the signing of that master's order with regard to the NBAR documents in order to put us to an election that would be conflicting. And we were not at the January 18th, 1990, it wasn't a hearing, it was a meeting that the special master had with regard to getting the order signed and having those documents sent up. That was done, and the special master's findings on those are conclusive in this original proceeding. Y'all are not here to find facts. In an original proceeding under Brady versus 14th Court, under your opinion in LaRouche versus Hanna, West versus Salito, not even to mention Jampo, the factual disputes that Remington and their attorneys attempt to create don't wash in this proceeding. The facts that are in these orders and the special master's order are taken as true. And if you look at those and take those as true, which I assume you will under your previous holdings, there is an intentional finding on the part of the master to keep the NBAR documents, to make that as close to the trial setting as possible, to force Mr. Craig and his attorneys to an election.
Mr. Longley, you focused all these things, all your initial comments here on pretrial matters, but let's focus on at the time Judge Martinez entered his order after the jury verdict against your client and Lisa's liability. What gives him the power to enter a sanction order if there is no discovery request at the time he makes the order?
Well, there were discovery requests.
Would you speak to that? Because this is a matter where it has
Justice Gonzalez, I'll be happy to. And my point here is there were continuing discovery requests. And as the court knows, under Rule 166B, as well as under Rule 215, all lawyers and litigants are under a continuing duty to supplement or to change something if it has become misleading or if it's become untrue. You're supposed to immediately disclose that, whether you're within 30 days of trial or not. These discovery requests have been outstanding ever since they were first filed. And they were under these continuing duties to do that. Judge Martinez did not grant the mistrial because of discovery abuse. He granted the mistrial because of the conduct of counsel and his client during trial. This is the infamous Valentine case in which counsel gave a Valentine to the jury on February 14, 1990. And that's addressed in the briefs. I'll not go into that. But it was trial conduct that caused the mistrial.
Right. Mistrial counsel, then, the remedy would be motion for, he would grant a mistrial as to liability and damages. Back to square one. Start over.
He did that.
He did not dismiss the pleading?
No, that came after he granted mistrial. That was done by separate order and separate hearing. Evidently, the court's under the impression that he granted both of these things at the same time. He granted the mistrial by a separate order, and then held a hearing on sanctions. And there's about there's several pages worth of hearing that you'll find at least in the record we brought to the court with regard to what was held at that hearing that was held on March the 17th, or maybe it was the 21st. I forget the exact date. But
what date was the mistrial?
I don't have the order right up here,
well,
but I can.
What gap of time?
I don't recall. I don't recall if they were signed on the same day or if they were signed, if there was a gap in between them. But the point is, I made a motion for new trial, and I also made a separate motion for sanctions. He did not act on my motion for new trial. He actually granted a mistrial based upon what Judge Kilgarlin asked me to do. He said, because we had the hearing prior to a judgment being entered, Judge Kilgarlin, and it's in our brief, at tab 57, you'll find it in the evidence, said, well, because there's been no judgment entered, Your Honor, if you're going to grant some sort of new trial, the proper procedure would be to grant a mistrial rather than a new trial. And that's exactly what Judge Martinez did, sua sponte, and entered his own order with regard to that.
I gather Mr. Kilgarlin didn't go ahead and ask for sanctions.
He did not ask for sanctions. We did ask for sanctions, and based upon the discovery abuses that had gone on before and the entire record before the judge at that time. Which, by the way, unless Downer versus Aquamarine and Medical Protective versus Glands are no longer the law, the trial judge has to grant sanctions based upon the entire record and the entire proceedings up till that time. And that would also include the Transamerican case after you sent this case back to Judge Martinez to review the sanctions order in light of that case. By the way, once that case went back, Remington at that time tried to get Judge Martinez objected to his appointment. That's a part of this briefing that we've done. I'll not dwell on it, but we claim, of course, that those objections were untimely filed under the statute.
Mr. Longley, under the Transamerican, can you discovery abuse has to demonstrate such bad faith that would give rise to an inference that Remington's defense is lacking merit. Can you explain to me how that inference can be drawn from the case in which Remington won the case to the jury?
Yes, sir, I can. And I think, Your Honor, in light of your Chrysler opinion last week, I believe that becomes one of the most important factors that has to be addressed. In this particular case, there are only three presumptions that could be made. Either A, their defenses did lack merit, which is the presumption I think that Judge Martinez came to, or else the conduct had to be explained by some intervening. The conduct is so reprehensible when you read this record, it could only be presumed to be something that was caused by some other factor that mental incompetency or illness or abuse of controlled substances or something. When you read this record, the only presumption you can come to, looking at this record with the abuses that took place throughout the entire proceedings, was that they had no valid defense. And that their stated goal with regard to discovery was making agreements then reneging on those agreements, having orders entered, then not complying with those orders, saying that they've produced all the documents when they haven't produced all the documents, and then engaging in trial conduct that once discovery had been completed, that the trial conduct was of a nature that was designed to either A, cause a Remington verdict, which is what they got, or B, a mistrial, and in this case, they got both. Now, Remington was found guilty of negligence and failing to warn, but there was a finding of no proximate cause with that, and the jury did assess $200,000 in punitive damages even with those non-findings.
So that we will not be like ships passing the night here and help me and try to get a handle on this case. Would you address the three main topics here, the team minutes, the photographs, and the testimony of Don Jackson as a basis for sanctions? Would you respond to the argument Mr. Ware made after these three items?
Well, first of all, the testimony of Don Jackson is of no moment. That's resolved against Remington because of the findings made in the court's orders and then the findings of the special master. This is an original proceeding, and we have to take those as being true. They can file affidavits and letters all day long disputing those factual developments, but as under Brady versus 14th Court of Appeals, LaRouche versus Hanna, Jampol, and West versus Alito, that's established in this case. Unless you all change those cases.
What is established?
The fact with regard to the so-called testimony of Mr. Jackson that he somehow had said what the photographer's name was, he was not under oath. This is some affidavit or letter that he's put into the record.
Well, what about the argument that the penalty for that is you don't get to testify? You know, you made an objection, objection sustained, and that ends the story. I mean, that's going to the next issue. That cannot be used as a trial for sanctions.
That was the photograph situation. The photographs did get into evidence even over my objection under those circumstances. And under that discrete, if you look at each abuse discreetly, I suppose, yes, you'd say the sanction for that is this, the sanction for this is that. But when you look at the entire record, as this trial court was called upon to do, to see the entire conduct of all the proceedings, including the trial conduct and the discovery abuses, that's what you have to look at if you're going to have some sort of death penalty standard.
What is your response to the team minutes?
The team minutes was exactly, again, it's this record is complete with regard to what the special master found as to the team minutes.
If there had been no pretrial abuses, or they evened out, could conduct of counsel during a trial ever rise to the level of outrageousness that a judge would be justified in striking defensive pleadings and proceeding to a trial only on damages?
Well, I think not only defensive pleadings, but offensive pleadings. I think you could do it with a plaintiff as well if the conduct was outrageous, not under Rule 215, but under the inherent powers of the court.
Do you know of any cases?
I do not know of any cases.
In this case, essentially, what we're looking at is some pretrial discovery matters, which under Downer you have to look at if there have been prior sanctions under the transmitter added to conduct at
And then post-verdict conduct, once you had a mistrial, you're back. I mean, you don't do away with discovery requests once the verdict has been set aside. Those discovery requests remain on file, not complied with, by the way, according to this record before this court. But the question is, are we going to have death penalty sanctions? That's the real question in this case, because you have before you here a case in which if you do not uphold the trial court's discretion in granting death penalty sanctions, I would respectfully submit to this court that there is no set of facts that can come before this court in which death penalty sanctions can be upheld.
Assuming you're correct that this is an appropriate case for death penalty sanctions, should Remington be penalized for counsel's conduct, or should there be some distinction made there?
There should be a distinction made, Your Honor. I think you're absolutely correct about that.
Has that been made in this case?
That has been made. If you look at the order that was entered after your Transamerican case, when you sent it back to Judge Martinez for reconsideration, he went to great pains to point out the distinction between Remington and Remington's attorneys, and I think you will find those discreetly placed in the order. Moreover, Judge Caldwell's initial sanction order was strictly against Remington, not against the attorneys. So throughout the record, you see that there is a distinction being made when one needs to be made.
So this sanction against Remington cannot be justified based on counsel's conduct during the trial?
No, I think it could be because of the record that you have before you in this case. Remington has a pattern, if you will, of engaging in this kind of conduct that is in this record. The Thompson case in California, the Musica case in Waco, the Castleberry case in Corpus Christi, you know, the Chapa cases, the Canales cases. By the way, we had the same ex parte affidavit in this case that was condemned in the Canales case only 3 weeks ago. The conduct here runs the gamut. I mean, you start with Rule 1 of the Rules of Procedure and go all the way to the end, and almost every one of those rules has been violated in some form or another by Remington or its counsel. We've been faced with the hiring of 18 lawyers, a virtual army of lawyers, to defend Remington in this, including Senator Green, who was used on at least one occasion to get a legislative continuance after this court sent it back to for the Transamerica reconsideration. There's been 9 mandamuses taken, even one threat mandamus from an evidentiary ruling in the trial. There's been
all
one appeal.
Has any of all the mandamuses you faced ever any kind of alternative dispute resolution? Has any of the many judges you have appeared in front of sent one or all these cases to any type of alternative dispute?
No, Your Honor, they have not. It's got to the point now where I went back and looked at 783 Southwest 2nd Justice Cook about the guidelines for civility that you find there that this court has certainly adopted and hope that counsel will deal with. And this is the case that the National Law Journal ran a front page article on called Rambo or Dumbo. The facts are so reprehensible that if there cannot be death penalty sanctions in this case, I would respectfully submit that the 215 and the court's rulings that have led up to death penalty sanctions there's a death knell with regard to the death penalty sanction.
If that be the case, Mr. Longley, and there is a death knell for death penalty sanctions, when was Mr. Craig injured?
Mr. Craig was injured in November of 1985. We have filed an affidavit with this court in an attempt to try to get an expedited hearing, but now we're almost 7 years since the day of the accident. He has been through almost over $300,000 in medical. The trial proceedings were so affected by Remington that they found zero with regard to future medical and zero mental anguish in violation of, for instance, the Roper decision that this court has handed down. In those instances, Mr. Craig has really been denied the due process if you look at who has been denied due process here.
I'm sure the jury heard all of this evidence, and they went down right the line against your client. What happened?
No, they did not get to hear all of the evidence because we were forced to this Hobson's choice with regard to the NBAR documents. And that is in the special master's report, which must be taken as true unless you're going to overrule these other cases, that was intentionally done to try to put us to that election. And because of Mr. Craig's injuries and because of his wishes, he wanted to go ahead and try to get the case tried. It wouldn't have done us any good to wait anyway because in the Chapa case, this court, 2 years after submission, still has that case pending with regard to the NBAR documents. So we don't know the outcome as to whether or not those documents will ultimately be denied as trade secrets or if they will actually be produced. They have been produced in other cases, and I have provided the court with those updated authorities as to where they have been produced. Thank you.
Any questions? Thank you.
May it please the court, Mr. Craig has had due process. He had a trial. He had a 4-week trial, and this morning we filed 37 volumes of a statement of facts from that trial, and if the court is of a mind to look at the trial conduct, I would hope that the court would consider the entire statement of facts. The reason is because there is no factual nexus to any prejudice that Mr. Craig has suffered by any discovery conduct on the part of Remington. Everything that Mr. Longley complained about on the order where we were sanctioned $25,000 was produced to him no later than sometime in May when we had the 2-day hearing in front of Judge Huebner, or the Special Master Huebner, and when he denied them any sanctions. They were allowed to prepare for trial. We had a hearing on November the 28th on the NBAR team minutes. After that hearing, the judicial master signed an order 1 week prior to trial saying that there were going to be no sanctions, and we did the one thing that we were allowed to do at that point in time, which was to take a mandamus. Mr. Longley and his client, presumably, made a decision to go to trial at that time. Everything else except 5 pages of team minutes they had when they went to trial. They talked about team minutes and introduced hundreds of pages of Remington documents and talked about them ad nauseum at trial. They got to prove the Coates settlement here in Austin, and Mr. Coates here in Austin, $6 million before the jury. They got to prove through the experts, through the testimony of a paid engineer, that Remington supposedly had been sanctioned in a case that occurred and concluded 10 years before in Thompson versus California. They got to prove,
well,
on these set of facts.
Counsel, I understand the interest of both of you in this hotly contested case to retry the case, but could you outline for us specifically how the findings that Judge Martinez made are deficient under Chrysler against Blackman?
How they're insufficient?
How they're insufficient or deficient.
Because there is no failure to comply with a discovery order, Your Honor.
Isn't there a finding of a failure to comply with orders in these written?
There is a finding. It should be accorded no greater respect than this Court suggests in that opinion, in addition to which, on this record, it is not supported by any evidence.
So it's not that the findings that he made do not comply as a matter of the requirements of Blackman, but that we should disregard one of those findings because it's not supported by the record.
There is no evidence and there is no finding in compliance with Transamerica on this record. The conclusionary statement in his order, which he signed back on December the 7th of 1991, is nothing more than a conclusionary statement.
And we're not required under these cases to accept his factual findings?
No, sir, you're not. Not under the Blackman Chrysler case, and not under any other authority in this jurisdiction.
Doesn't that mean we basically have a de novo review of every death penalty sanctions case?
In every death penalty sanctions case, the review does not have to be de novo in the sense that you have to read every record item. The review is de novo in the sense that you have to examine whether or not there is evidence giving rise to the presumption. And here, there is no evidence giving rise to the presumption. And I understand Chrysler to be an effort by this Court to limit the scope of the review that the Court's going to have to go under. And I will read, and I would like to have a request. I'd like to request leave to respond to Mr. Longley's brief he filed the day before yesterday. But also, I would like to see your dissent on that, and we will try to respond to that also, Your Honor. And I'm not going to rag any further about the record except to say they also got to prove to the front of this jury that we were sanctioned $25,000. And Remington rested in this case at the end of the plaintiff's case. I didn't call a single witness in this case. Mr. Longley lost, not because I'm Dumbo or trying to be Rambo. He had 6 lawyers with him in the court at times, and Mr. Jackson and I were the only 2 lawyers from Remington to show up in court. He lost this case because the jury heard about all of those documents until they were sick about them, and because they were not convinced that Mr. Craig's witnesses were being truthful as to how the accident happened. That's why they lost the case.
Any questions? Thank you. That concludes the argument in the third cause and concludes the court's submission schedule for this morning. Foregoing causes are submitted. All briefs and oral arguments. Marshall.